Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI proclaims five new saints as role models for a disoriented society. South Africa's new elected leader vows to unite the country. We take a look at who he is, what his priorities are, and at the role of the church in this moment of democratic growth. And film critic Peter Malone brings a taste of two chilling thrillers with a good twist at the end. Pope Benedict XVI offered five religious, he proclaimed saints, as role models for a disoriented society, and said that in them one can find inspiration to overcome the obstacles and crises of life. The Pope was speaking on Sunday at the canonization ceremony in St. Peter's Square, in which he declared four Italians and one Portuguese saints of the Church. Lydia O'Kane has this report.
Pilgrims had come from near and far, and even the threat of rain didn't stop them from being present on Sunday in St. Peter's Square to watch Pope Benedict celebrate the canonization of five new saints of the Church.
La luce del volto di Cristo risorto risplende oggi su di noi particolarmente attraverso.
Of the five saints canonized on Sunday, four were Italian and one was Portuguese. During his sermon, the Holy Father spent time talking about the qualities of each one, qualities and values which now make them saints.
Arcangelo Tadini.
The Pope described the Italian-born founder of the Congregation of the Worker Sisters of the Holy House of Nazareth, new saint Arcangelo Tadini, as a true man of God who was ready in times of urgency to seize the moment and find a solution, and added that his charismatic intuition today remains an example to us in an era of serious economic crises.
Bernardo Tolomeo.
The Pope said the Italian abbot and founder of the Benedictine Congregation of the Blessed Virgin of Monte Oliveto, St. Bernardo Tolomei, was also an example of selfless charity who devoted himself to work and prayer and died helping others.
Nuno de Santa Maria Álvares Pereira.
Paying homage to the only Portuguese blessed among the five canonized, Pope Benedict, speaking in Portuguese, said that St. Nuno de Santa Maria Álvares Pereira, founder of the Congregation of the Blessed Virgin of Monte Oliveto, was a former soldier in battle who had a deep love for God, adding that he is a witness to the fact that even with a military character, it is possible to act and carry out the values of Christian life.
Gertrude Comenzoli e Caterina Volpicelli.
Of the two women who became saints on Sunday, Pope Benedict described Gertrude Comensoli, founder of the Institute of the Blessed Sacrament, and Caterina Volpicelli, founder of the Institute of the Handmaidens of the Sacred Heart, as witnesses of divine love. St. Gertrude, the Pope said, even today, by her devotion, can show the young, often injured and lost in our society, the way to God in the form of the Eucharist. The Holy Father also said that St. Caterina's strength in bringing Christ to the people of Naples at a time of spiritual and social crisis is an example of how it is possible to build an open society of justice, surpassing economical and cultural imbalance that continue to exist in much of our world. Sunday's canonization of these five blesseds brings the number of saints created by Pope Benedict to 19 since the start of his pontificate. And as the Pope himself put it, these new saints shine like bright examples of sanctity. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Thanks there to Lydia O'Kane for that report. Much has been achieved, much needs to be done. But first of all, says South African Cardinal Wilfred Napier in a just released statement, congratulations, South Africa. Congratulations for a fair and free electoral run. That's the sound of South Africans celebrating election results. And Cardinal Napier is the Archbishop of Durban and the spokesman of the Southern African Catholic Bishops' Conference. His statement follows a sweeping election victory on Saturday by South Africa's ruling ANC party. But the Cardinal is quick to put those congratulations into context, pointing out that in this election, the real victory belongs to all the South Africans who voted. The voting turnout, he says, deserves celebration. It's a powerful sign of how a democratic culture has taken hold of our national consciousness. Last week's election in South Africa was seen as a momentous moment for the nation, 15 years after that legendary day in 1994, when Nelson Mandela defeated the evils of apartheid and led his countrymen into a new era of democracy, growth and hope.
Dear friends, comrades and fellow South Africans, I greet you all in the name of peace, democracy and freedom for all.
Since then, South Africans have had the chance to start anew and to be accepted as respected world players in a democratic scenario. But they've also had to deal with a host of critical issues caused by widespread poverty, a crippling HIV pandemic, and the lengthening shadows of corruption. But as Cardinal Napier told me, the Bishops' Conference has been behind the people of South Africa in the run-up to the election day, encouraging them to go to the polls with conviction and respect.
I think what we felt was that many people are expressing disappointment, the lack of delivery, the lack of progress, particularly the poor lack of progress in advancement, which they had been promised and which they had hoped would happen. And there was a real danger, I think, that people would have gone into a state of apathy. It's not worth voting because nothing's going to be done anyway. I think this was repeated so often that all the political parties certainly seem to have got the message. And in their manifestos, they were positively putting out what they can or would do about the different problems. I think that encouraged a lot of people eventually to go out and vote. Also, the possibility of change with the appearance of a new party that split away from the ANC, the COPE, I think that also has encouraged people to put more competitiveness into the whole situation.
Cardinal Napier was mentioning the appearance of COPE, short for Congress of the People, the party that was formed last year by a group which split from the ANC after ex-president Thabo Mbeki was replaced as leader. But the man in the limelight since then has been, and still is, Jacob Zuma, current leader of the ANC, and almost certainly president-to-be.
To those South Africans who did not vote for the ANC, we'll form a government that takes care of your needs to the best of our ability. Working together, we will make it a government for all South Africans.
In his first speech to the nation after the victory of his party, Zuma is careful to reassure all South Africans that his aim is to unite the country and to work to improve the delivery of services.
Now that the election is over, we must enter a new era of hope and progress. We must enter a period where we bury mistrust, uncertainty, pain and tension, and begin a new chapter of harmony and collaboration. We cannot afford to dwell on the negatives. We have gone through a difficult period over a few years. It is now time to put it all behind us.
Jacob Zuma speaks of the need to put times behind us. Partly, he's referring to himself, or rather to the perception many people have of Zuma as a person and as a leader. In fact, he has been in and out of court a number of times in the past 4 years, responding to charges of fraud, rape, and corruption in connection with arms dealing. He also likes to appear in public wearing traditional Zulu leopard skins and openly endorses ethnic practices such as polygamy and prayers to ancestors. Nor does he disdain performing publicly at political rallies, dancing and singing, as well as talking to the crowds. I tried to find out what is the secret of Jacob Zuma's success.
The secret of his success, I think, is in one sense positive and in one sense negative.
Mike Boothier is a research director at the Catholic Parliamentary Liaison Office in Cape Town.
Start with the negative side. He presents an alternative to President Mbeki. Mbeki was an intellectual, rather distant, rather aloof, a great centralizer, an autocrat, in fact. His word was law within the ruling party, and because the ruling party have had an almost two-thirds majority practically in parliament for the last 10 years, what the president had to say more or less became the way things were. And more people, not so much outside of the ruling party, but inside the ruling party and in the trade unions and its other allies, we're getting sick and tired of this. Jacob Zuma represents a far more approachable, far more in touch, far more sympathetic personality than Mbeki. And so in that, if I can call that the negative sense, he simply offers something which the previous president did not offer.
In a more positive sense, says Mike, Zuma has a clearer understanding of the aspirations, the demands, the grievances of ordinary people.
Those that have maybe not been properly attended to over the last 15 years of our democracy. People have been left on the margins. Zuma has a way of sympathizing, identifying with them. He's also a populist. To come back to your question, he says things which are disturbing because he contradicts himself from one day to the next in some of the positions that he takes. He does that because he wants to please everybody. He ends up then perhaps not pleasing anybody sufficiently well.
You were speaking of the fact that for many years the leadership of the ANC seems not to have really been delivering the promises made to the people. And the people of South Africa are grappling with severe problems, poverty, HIV, crime, corruption. I know that a large majority of the people still live in slum-like conditions, many without electricity, without water. Unemployment is extremely high. Does the South African leadership, whichever it may be, have the resources to do something about these problems?
Yes, we do have the resources. You know, this is not a poor country by any means. Certainly by developing country standards, we're quite well off. And I know about 10 years ago when our bishops released the pastoral document on economic justice, the research there showed that we had a per capita income more or less equivalent to that of a country like Poland. So this is not a poor country. We've had a problem over the years, obviously, with distribution of wealth, and we can trace that back quite largely to the apartheid system, obviously, which favored the white community. We've had quite generous tax cuts over the last number of years in the annual budget, and we have run a budget surplus, not in the present year, obviously, with the worldwide economic crisis, but for the two previous years, we had a budget surplus, which is very unusual for a developing country. Our problem lies more in the question of how we manage this money, how we actually apply it, how we plan, and how our government departments manage to spend it. And that's where incompetence, lack of training, lack of experience, a degree of corruption, which I don't think should be exaggerated, but it is there, all of those factors mean that our available resources are not being efficiently and effectively applied to where they are needed most.
In response to that very same question, Cardinal Napier is in agreement with Mike Pothier, but adds an extra dimension.
I think there are two very important things that we have to do on the way forward. The first one is certainly to get the government to galvanize itself into action in the areas that you have indicated: poverty, education, healthcare, rural development, tackling crime and corruption. I think, you know, the program is laid out there, and many of them have put that in their manifestos. But I think an equally important factor to have in mind in the way forward is that government cannot do everything. We have got to start doing things ourselves. And to expect government to create jobs or businesses to create jobs is just not going to happen in the kind of climate that we're in at the moment. And therefore, I think one of the important things that the leadership of our government, of our country, and the political parties that are going to be in opposition is to convince our people that we've got to do a lot more ourselves. You know, I visited Africa for the Pope's visit in Cameroon and Angola, and I'm amazed at the difference of attitude in those countries compared with us. We are still very much, possibly because we know that we have a country of wealthy resources, we're still sitting back and saying government must do this and government must do that. So what I see in those other countries is where government is not able to do it and the people are doing it for themselves. And I think we've got to start getting that into the equation as well.
I was so relieved to hear their views, but with trepidation took my question one step further.
It's encouraging to hear that you think that South Africa does have the resources, because one of the other preoccupations that has been undercurrent in the Western press, in the European press, is could South Africa be going the same way as Zimbabwe?
Yes. You know, you can't make any predictions with 100% certainty, but our history and our situation is so different from that of Zimbabwe in various different ways. We have constitutional structures which are far more powerfully entrenched than they ever were in Zimbabwe. We have opposition within our politics which is far stronger than was ever the case in Zimbabwe. Our business sector, our judiciary, our academic sector, and perhaps above all our civil society sector is very, very strong, very, very vociferous. Government simply cannot get away with radical maneuvers such as Robert Mugabe has pulled off in Zimbabwe over the last 10 or 15 years. And I must also say that there is no indication from even the most militant or extreme members of the African National Congress that that party has tensions to go in that direction. This is a functioning multi-party democracy. We have little moans here and there about certain abuses of power. I don't think that they are any more serious, by and large, than what one sees in many European and First World countries. And I think most people are quite optimistic. But, of course, we must be on our guard. We must resist even the beginnings, even the first inklings of abuse of government power, abuse of constitutional rights, and so on. And as I say, our institutions of state and our civil society is very strong in that respect.
There's one question I'd like to ask you. You may think it's irrelevant, but it's struck the imagination out here. We saw Nelson Mandela at a rally the other day with Jacob Zuma. He gave a message that was clearly pre-recorded.
A united, non-racial society. Working together, we can do more. I thank you.
What is his role in this process?
Mandela has the role of icon. I mean, that is the term that is used here. He's the great icon of the struggle against apartheid, of the struggle for liberation. He says very little these days. He doesn't appear in public very much. But he has one almost wants to say, a kind of spiritual role, this father of the nation role. He's universally respected and admired and esteemed and loved. And he certainly still identifies with the ANC, the party that he's served all his life. That's never going to change. But maybe a stabilizing role to some extent, the fact that he is still there in the background. But through all the ructions in the ANC over the last couple of years, with changes in leadership and the acrimony that's accompanied, that Mandela stayed completely quiet and apart from it. He doesn't get involved in the day-to-day politics at all. But he sits there in the background. He's still there. He is still some sort of a point of reference for all of us.
And another point of reference for all of us is, of course, the Church. I began this program with the words of Cardinal Napier, congratulating South Africans for having done their part in solidifying democracy. He also confirmed that the Bishops' Conference remains steady in supporting whoever is at the helm of the country, reminding elected representatives that they are called to be effective lawmakers, followers of the law, and guardians of the common good and of the Constitution. For an election, Napier says, is not a path to power, but a call to service.
Yes, and I think we will do very much like the American bishops have done. They've written to Barack Obama and have said to him, congratulations. But these are the challenges that we are going to have to face together. These are the areas where we disagree. But we would have to work on those areas to try and arrive at a position where we can, I suppose, cross-fertilize our ideas and move forward and try and do what's best for our people. Certainly the Bishops' Conference is going to be behind whoever is in government, making it known where we differ from them, but also giving them our full support. And it's not just the Bishops' Conference. I'm involved with an interreligious council here in KwaZulu-Natal, and we've formed ourselves specifically so that we can enter into realistic partnerships with the provincial government, and we would like to see the same thing happen at national level so that, you know, the religious community, which has got very, very good outreach into every level of society, how we could use our resources and our networks to bring some of the government projects to realization.
And now we go over to our friend, film critic Peter Malone, who heads the film office at Cygnus, the World Catholic Association for Communication. Today he speaks about two rather creepy films for those of you who enjoy a blood-curdling moment or two whilst munching your popcorn. Peter, let's move on to a range of films which are probably for a wider audience. The creepy film, and the first one
Do you like creepy films?
No, I get scared stiff. I can't watch them. I spend my time under the seat.
These are fairly moderate. You could try these out. The two that I'd like to mention are The Uninvited is one, and The Haunting in Connecticut is the other.
Okay. Well, let's start with The Uninvited. Thriller, right?
It is a thriller. And with a twist, which I must say I didn't pick up at all. And that's always satisfying when you get such a surprise at the end. But if you've seen The Sixth Sense and a few films like that, you'll probably get some practice and think, uh-oh, this could be the solution. But I didn't.
So it's a supernatural thriller, if you're referring to The Sixth Sense.
Well, no, this one isn't quite. That's part of the trick, I suppose. Mm-hmm. You think it is. I'd call it more a psychological thriller. In fact, the girl at the centre of it is in an institution at the beginning of the film, suffering trauma after her mother's death in a fire.
Why can't I remember what happened that night?
You lost your mother in a fire. Maybe it's not such a bad thing to forget. Go home. You'll figure it out.
Can you tell us the story?
Well, it's just simply she goes home then, and her father has the woman who is looking after the mother and is intending to marry her, and there's her older sister, and she's trying to settle back, but she gets very suspicious of the woman who's going to marry.
And I'm sorry, I meant to tell you about Rachel.
When did she move in?
A month ago. She's helping him cope, 3 times a night.
She gets suspicious of a young man who saw what happened that night, and he disappears, etc.
So it's the story of the daughters and the wicked stepmother, in a way, from what you're saying.
Listen, Anna, I know that you're supposed to hate Dad's new girlfriend, but I'm really hoping that we can make this work.
It is, and that's where something of the twist occurs. It's a short film, and it's pleasant to look at. There are not too many shocks and jumps, but some eerie atmosphere, especially as they're trying to deal with the wicked stepmother.
Alex, something happened.
Yeah?
I had a dream.
There were children. I think they were trying to warn us.
Your daughter got it in her mind somehow that your fiancé killed the family she worked for.
Look at this.
You speak well of the performance of Emily Browning.
Well, I have to. She's from Melbourne. Now, she's been in a few films as a child actress, and now she's grown up, and she has to sustain, the credibility of the whole film. And when you watch the ending of it, you realise that she has done quite a good performance for it.
Well, I think I could deal with that, a mystery thriller then, yes, rather than a supernatural one.
Pretty Little Anna, you're not going to ruin this for me.
The other one we're talking about today is The Haunting in Connecticut.
And that's got the touch of the, if not the supernatural, at least the supranatural, just a bit above ordinary things.
It's something of a little haunted house shocker, isn't it?
It is, but it spends a lot of time on characters and plot.
Why do bad things happen to good people? We're just a regular family like anybody else. We didn't ask for this, and we didn't deserve it.
You know that the house is going to be haunted because during the credits you see some photos of an undertaker. It was, you find out it was the house of an undertaker who posed all the bodies and took photos, but something more sinister is gradually revealed, and a young boy who seems to have been a medium in the past and they had seances perhaps starts to possess one of the characters.
It's perfect. It's spacious and affordable. I'm just wondering, where's the catch?
Well, it does have a bit of a history.
So they spent a lot of time because the main boy is a teenager with terminal cancer, and his mother is very concerned, and she wants to find a place near the hospital which has offered some experimental treatment. Mm-hmm. And so that's why they rent the house. And all the things that happen after that. So you probably don't jump too much in the first hour, but there's a few jumps and a few scary things and a climax.
A few decent scares.
I've seen this kid almost every day since we've been here.
You're scaring me.
We'll join the club.
Yes, so it's a variation on the haunted house, but with a grim perspective, especially, you know, you're concerned about the mother and her care for her son and the boy with the terminal illness.
You must get out now!
Matt! I have to get my son!
How that is developing, and his cousin comes to stay as well as a younger brother and sister, and the father comes now and again because he has to keep his job in order to pay for the rental of the house. So audiences could identify with a lot of the aspects of it, even if it says based on a true story.
That's what I was going to ask you. Based on a true story?
Yes, and pull the other one, I suppose, is the answer to that, or take it with a grain of salt.
So check it out. They'd held seances in this house. People not only contacted the dead, but made things appear.
Okay.
It's very much like the Amityville Horror, which allegedly was true, but they're all invented.
I don't know if I could do that one, actually. Yeah, I'd probably spend my time in the bathroom.
There is something in this house.
You've been warned, then.
Something no longer living and not yet passed over.
What happened in the house?
Something evil. And it wants your son.
And for those of you who enjoy some intellectual stimulation, don't forget to join Peter next week at this same time for a foretaste of three very different biographies with lots of interesting facts and figures. That's all from the English feature programme today, and from me, Linda Bordoni, but we will be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.